University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Session 2006. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your center number, candidate number, and name on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are six questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each question twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. How much did Nuria pay for the CD?
Hi, Yasmin. Come and listen to my new CD.
I'd love to, Nuria. How much did you pay for it?
It was a bargain. They wanted $7, but they let me have it for only $5. Hi, Yasmin. Come and listen to my new CD.
I'd love to, Nuria. How much did you pay for it?
It was a bargain. They wanted $7, but they let me have it for only $5.
Question 2. Which two measures must be taken to stop the smoke alarm sounding?
What's that ringing noise? Is it the smoke alarm?
Yes. I've burnt the toast and there's smoke pouring out of the toaster, so open the windows quickly.
OK, but it would help if you turned off the power to the toaster too. What's that ringing noise? Is it the smoke alarm?
Yes. I've burnt the toast and there's smoke pouring out of the toaster, so open the windows quickly.
OK, but it would help if you turned off the power to the toaster too.
Question 3. Why should the guests arrive early for Roxana's party?
It's Roxana's birthday tomorrow. We're going to hold a surprise party for her at 7:30. I've told her to come to my house then, but haven't said why. Make sure you come at 7, so there's plenty of time to hide. And then we'll leap out and surprise her when she arrives.
Sounds fun. Let's all bring some nice food along.
That's a great idea. It's Roxana's birthday tomorrow. We're going to hold a surprise party for her at 7:30. I've told her to come to my house then, but haven't said why. Make sure you come at 7, so there's plenty of time to hide. And then we'll leap out and surprise her when she arrives.
Sounds fun. Let's all bring some nice food along.
That's a great idea.
Question 4. What time do the supporters have to be on the coach?
The team are playing their final match tomorrow. If you want to travel with them as supporters, you'll be welcome as there are places on the coach. But do try to be on time. It's 9 o'clock in the morning at the very latest. If you get there at 5 or 10 past, you're going to miss it. The team are playing their final match tomorrow. If you want to travel with them as supporters, you'll be welcome, as there are places on the coach. But do try to be on time. It's 9 o'clock in the morning at the very latest. If you get there at 5 or 10 past, you're going to miss it.
Question 5. What is Mr. Rashid's extension number?
Hello, Luke Smith's office. How may I help?
Oh, I'm not sure if I've come through to the right place. I wanted to speak to Mr. Rashid. I know it's extension 3247.
Ah, this is 3274. You've misdialed.
Oh, I see. Very sorry to disturb you.
Hello, Luke Smith's office. How may I help?
Oh, I'm not sure if I've come through to the right place. I wanted to speak to Mr. Rashid. I know it's extension 3247.
Ah, this is 3274. You've misdialed.
Oh, I see. Very sorry to disturb you.
Question 6. Where do the robbers decide to meet, and for what purpose?
Look at this map. We're here, just round the corner from the station. The market, the river and the bank are to our right, and the shops are quite a long way away on the left.
Let's all meet back here at the station, then, in a couple of hours.
No, it's better to meet in the marketplace in an hour's time. It's not far away, and we can arrange the plan for tomorrow there, before we separate to catch different trains and go home.
Good idea. Yes, we'll do that.
Look at this map. We're here, just round the corner from the station. The market, the river and the bank are to our right, and the shops are quite a long way away on the left.
Let's all meet back here at the station, then, in a couple of hours.
No, it's better to meet in the marketplace in an hour's time. It's not far away, and we can arrange the plan for tomorrow there, before we separate to catch different trains and go home.
Good idea. Yes, we'll do that.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part two. Part 2, Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a chauffeur and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to Career Profile. Is driving rich and famous people around to glamorous places a dream job? Well, today on Career Profile, we are going to talk to Russell Chan about his job as a professional driver, a chauffeur. Hello, Russell, and welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Russell, what exactly does a chauffeur's job involve?
It is very varied and full of responsibilities, and is certainly not the dream job that many people consider it to be. You probably imagine that we drive famous people all over the world in top luxury vehicles, and that we receive good wages for an easy job. Well, you are wrong. There's much more to being a chauffeur than just driving around.
Tell us what, then?
Chauffeurs have to be impartial. Our first concern is always the safety and comfort of the passenger. This could be a businessman, politician, film star, or pop idol. A driver must never be distracted by the status of a passenger, but must concentrate on being punctual and polite and being a perfect driver.
But I've often seen chauffeurs waiting around outside.
and often they appear to be eating crisps or watching the in-car television. What a hard life.
Certainly a good proportion of our day is spent in preparation and waiting, and a small amount of time is actually spent driving. We do have to plan our day, including times, routes and journeys. So we have to think ahead. It's all part of good time management and personal organisation.
And so you have to maintain and clean the car too, do you?
Oh, yes. The driver must ensure that the car is clean, tidy and safe. Any problems would mean trouble, and perhaps the loss of your job. In previous years, the chauffeur had to be an experienced car mechanic too.
Do you personally have to keep the engine in good order?
Yes. In the sense that I have to check the oil, brakes and water levels daily. Even though modern vehicles have such good and reliable warning systems, it is still possible for disaster to strike. I also check the tyres and lights regularly.
It makes sense to do so.
All professional chauffeurs have to attend to detail. We provide so much more than a one-off fast taxi service. We drive our passengers with a high degree of skill, safety and planning.
You said that you always have to be courteous.
Yes. Even if we are angry at the way someone has spoken to us, a chauffeur must always remain calm. Courtesy means opening the door for the passenger, providing a smooth ride, and keeping the car clean, safe and fueled.
Do you usually drive large cars?
Oh, yes. They are usually large, comfortable saloons with automatic transmission. It is a luxurious image.
Yes, I can just imagine you driving your car. Do you have to wear a uniform nowadays?
Usually. I always wear a suit and a peaked cap. But chauffeurs' uniforms can vary from jeans and T-shirt or a casual suit to complete formal uniforms.
So, how did you become a chauffeur?
I had to complete a specialist driver training course and take a sort of advanced driving test. Driving professionally means intense and continuous concentration, and that is why I look forward to the rest periods you mentioned earlier.
Thank you, Russell Chan.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Career Profile. Is driving rich and famous people around to glamorous places a dream job? Well, today on Career Profile, we are going to talk to Russell Chan about his job as a professional driver, a chauffeur. Hello, Russell, and welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Russell, what exactly does a chauffeur's job involve?
It is very varied and full of responsibilities, and is certainly not the dream job that many people consider it to be. You probably imagine that we drive famous people all over the world in top luxury vehicles, and that we receive good wages for an easy job. Well, you are wrong. There's much more to being a chauffeur than just driving around.
Tell us what, then?
Chauffeurs have to be impartial. Our first concern is always the safety and comfort of the passenger. This could be a businessman, politician, film star or pop idol. A driver must never be distracted by the status of a passenger, but must concentrate on being punctual and polite and being a perfect driver.
But I've often seen chauffeurs waiting around outside, and often they appear to be eating crisps or watching the in-car television. What a hard life.
Certainly a good proportion of our day is spent in preparation and waiting, and a small amount of time is actually spent driving. We do have to plan our day, including times, routes and journeys. So we have to think ahead. It's all part of good time management and personal organisation.
And so you have to maintain and clean the car too, do you?
Oh, yes. The driver must ensure that the car is clean, tidy and safe. Any problems would mean trouble, and perhaps the loss of your job. In previous years, the chauffeur had to be an experienced car mechanic, too.
Do you personally have to keep the engine in good order?
Yes, in the sense that I have to check the oil, brakes and water levels daily. Even though modern vehicles have such good and reliable warning systems, it is still possible for disaster to strike. I also check the tyres and lights regularly.
It makes sense to do so.
All professional chauffeurs have to attend to detail. We provide so much more than a one-off fast taxi service. We drive our passengers with a high degree of skill, safety and planning.
You said that you always have to be courteous.
Yes. Even if we are angry at the way someone has spoken to us, a chauffeur must always remain calm. Courtesy means opening the door for the passenger, providing a smooth ride, and keeping the car clean, safe, and fueled.
Do you usually drive large cars?
Oh, yes. They are usually large, comfortable saloons with automatic transmission. It is a luxurious image.
Yes, I can just imagine you driving your car. Do you have to wear a uniform nowadays?
Usually. I always wear a suit and a peaked cap. But chauffeurs' uniforms can vary from jeans and T-shirt or a casual suit to complete formal uniforms.
So, how did you become a chauffeur?
I had to complete a specialist driver training course and take a sort of advanced driving test. Driving professionally means intense and continuous concentration, and that is why I look forward to the rest periods you mentioned earlier.
Thank you, Russell Chan.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about environmentally friendly houses called Earthships, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello. Today we are going to hear about one of the most environmentally friendly buildings in the world. Called an Earthship, this house has walls made of rubber tyres and cans. Builders claim that their creation will still be standing in 800 years' time. Is this a glimpse of the homes of the future? Rafika Azman, an Earthship builder, is here to tell us more. Hello, Rafika.
Hello. Yes, our houses are designed to recycle waste for their building structure. They use as little as possible of the Earth's resources when lived in.
I see. How do you use the recycled materials?
As you say, the walls are made out of old tyres. Old glass bottles and cans provide insulation. The wooden cupboards in the house are made of recycled wood.
Does your Earthship look like a conventional house?
Not really. We always build facing south, partially embedded into the ground and in the shape of two letter U's.
Why that particular shape?
It gives us more space to fix solar panels on the outside of the building. These provide the power for heating the rooms, water and appliances.
So why is it called an Earthship then? Does it look like a ship at all?
Well, yes. I suppose the design is a little like that. Its size and shape all add to the effect, but it has huge windows all around.
Ah. Tell us more about the environmental aspects of the house.
Well, rainwater is collected on a specially designed roof which filters it for household use. All of this water is eventually reused, some of it in the garden.
None just runs away down a drain. Everything is recycled.
Ah.
The house has no connection to water or power supplies. It is completely self-sufficient.
So how much does one of these houses cost to build?
About 100,000 euros. But remember that these houses cost nothing to run once you are living in them. They are full of natural light and warmth.
Are there many Earthships at present in the world?
Well, we started building the first Earthship in New Mexico, and most parts of the world are now building an experimental one. They are the houses of the future.
So, Rafika, where can we find out more?
On our website, www.earthship.org.
Now you'll hear the interview again.
Hello. Today we are going to hear about one of the most environmentally friendly buildings in the world. Called an Earthship, this house has walls made of rubber tyres and cans. Builders claim that their creation will still be standing in 800 years' time. Is this a glimpse of the homes of the future? Rafika Azman, an Earthship builder, is here to tell us more. Hello, Rafika.
Hello. Yes, our houses are designed to recycle waste for their building structure. They use as little as possible of the Earth's resources when lived in.
I see. How do you use the recycled materials?
As you say, the walls are made out of old tyres. Old glass bottles and cans provide insulation. The wooden cupboards in the house are made of recycled wood.
Does your Earthship look like a conventional house?
Not really. We always build facing south, partially embedded into the ground and in the shape of two letter U's.
Why that particular shape?
It gives us more space to fix solar panels on the outside of the building. These provide the power for heating the rooms, water and appliances.
So why is it called an Earthship then? Does it look like a ship at all?
Well, yes. I suppose the design is a little like that. Its size and shape all add to the effect, but it has huge windows all around.
Ah. Tell us more about the environmental aspects of the house.
Well, rainwater is collected on a specially designed roof, which filters it for household use. All of this water is eventually reused, some of it in the garden. None just runs away down a drain. Everything is recycled.
Ah.
The house has no connection to water or power supplies. It is completely self-sufficient.
So how much does one of these houses cost to build?
About 100,000 euros. But remember that these houses cost nothing to run once you are living in them. They are full of natural light and warmth.
Are there many Earthships at present in the world?
Well, we started building the first Earthship in New Mexico, and most parts of the world are now building an experimental one. They are the houses of the future.
So, Rafika, where can we find out more?
On our website, www.earthship.org.
Now turn to part two. You will hear a woman called Angela Thomas, who works for a wildlife organisation, talking about the spectacled bear. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at part 2.
Thanks for inviting me tonight. As you know, my main interest is in conservation, and I'm lucky enough to work with lots of different organisations looking after animals both in captivity and in the wild. I'd been fascinated by all kinds of bears for a long time before I started working in this field, but it was the spectacled bear that really attracted me. Some people find it appealing because of its size and shape, and it's less well known than other types of bear. But for me, I thought it was such a great name. It comes from the patches of yellowish fur around the bear's eyes, which grow in a sort of circle shape, like glasses. Although these golden markings vary greatly from one bear to another and may not be limited to the eyes, they can extend as far as the bear's cheeks or even chest. I'd like to explain what we know about this bear and why I find it so fascinating. It's the only survivor of a type of bear that once ranged across America during the last ice age. We thought that it was only found in certain places, in Venezuela and Chile, but I was thrilled to read some reports that suggested it might also be living in northern parts of Argentina and eastern Panama. It's quite difficult to find spectacled bears in the wild because they are quite shy animals and tend to live in a wide variety of habitats, which can range from dry coastal deserts to high mountain areas above 4,000 metres. They are most commonly found in forests, though. Being such timid animals, they tend to come out at night, which is another thing that makes them difficult to see, though, like me, you may be surprised to learn that they don't sleep all through the winter, as many other types of bear do. We're not sure about the actual number of spectacled bears that remain in the wild, but it's been estimated that there are only about 2,400 still around. The bears are endangered, not so much because they are hunted by other animals, but what I find really sad is the fact that humans destroy their habitat. Spectacled bears are quite small compared with other bears, and of course they do have other enemies. These mostly include mountain lions and jaguars, but they remain a smaller threat. The bears are primarily vegetarian, and their normal diet is tree bark and berries. On rare occasions, though, they eat honey, which I thought was just something in children's books. I was interested to find that they are incredibly good climbers, and one thing I found really funny is that they've been known to sit up in a tree for days. They make a platform. Why? I couldn't guess, but they're waiting for fruit to ripen so they can eat it. It's quite surprising that although they rarely eat meat, they have extremely strong jaws and wide, flat teeth. Very occasionally they do eat meat, something like birds or insects, though they like small mice best if they can get them. We're really trying to make people more aware of the bears, and we've made a television series about one man's efforts to make people understand the dangers facing the animals. He spent a long time in Peru studying them and has published a very funny diary of his time there. I hope everyone will read it and support our efforts to help these fascinating creatures. So, are there any questions?
Now you will hear part two again.
Thanks for inviting me tonight. As you know, my main interest is in conservation, and I'm lucky enough to work with lots of different organisations looking after animals both in captivity and in the wild. I'd been fascinated by all kinds of bears for a long time before I started working in this field, but it was the spectacled bear that really attracted me. Some people find it appealing because of its size and shape, and it's less well known than other types of bear. But for me, I thought it was such a great name. It comes from the patches of yellowish fur around the bear's eyes, which grow in a sort of circle shape, like glasses, although these golden markings vary greatly from one bear to another and may not be limited to the eyes. They can extend as far as the bear's cheeks or even chest. I'd like to explain what we know about this bear and why I find it so fascinating. It's the only survivor of a type of bear that once ranged across America during the last ice age. We thought that it was only found in certain places, in Venezuela and Chile, but I was thrilled to read some reports that suggested it might also be living in northern parts of Argentina and eastern Panama. It's quite difficult to find spectacled bears in the wild because they are quite shy animals and tend to live in a wide variety of habitats, which can range from dry coastal deserts to high mountain areas above 4,000 metres. They are most commonly found in forests, though. Being such timid animals, they tend to come out at night, which is another thing that makes them difficult to see, though, like me, you may be surprised to learn that they don't sleep all through the winter, as many other types of bear do. We're not sure about the actual number of spectacled bears that remain in the wild, but it's been estimated that there are only about 2,400 still around. The bears are endangered, not so much because they are hunted by other animals, but what I find really sad is the fact that humans destroy their habitat. Spectacled bears are quite small compared with other bears, and of course they do have other enemies. These mostly include mountain lions and jaguars, but they remain a smaller threat. The bears are primarily vegetarian, and their normal diet is tree bark and berries. On rare occasions, though, they eat honey, which I thought was just something in children's books. I was interested to find that they are incredibly good climbers, and one thing I found really funny is that they've been known to sit up in a tree for days. They make a platform. Why? I couldn't guess, but they're waiting for fruit to ripen so they can eat it. It's quite surprising that although they rarely eat meat, they have extremely strong jaws and wide, flat teeth. Very occasionally they do eat meat, something like birds or insects, though they like small mice best if they can get them. We're really trying to make people more aware of the bears, and we've made a television series about one man's efforts to make people understand the dangers facing the animals. He spent a long time in Peru studying them and has published a very funny diary of his time there. I hope everyone will read it and support our efforts to help these fascinating creatures. So, are there any questions?
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about their visit to a city. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to H what each speaker liked most about the city they visited. Use the letters only once. There are three extra letters which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds to look at part three. Speaker 1.
We spent a day exploring the shops and markets in the city and bought some souvenirs. Then we wanted to see some of the area outside the city and discovered it was easy to get to loads of places by train, including the mountains, where we were told there were great hostels. You can do bushwalks out there, and apparently the scenery is stunning. But it can be dangerous. We were warned to have the right gear and tell other people where we were going, so we decided to give it a miss. Anyway, we weren't short of things to do in the city. We were spoilt for choice.
Speaker 2. We were pretty tired when we first arrived, so we were glad just to relax. We'd booked late, and I have to say that the room wasn't the best I've stayed in, but we had a view of the lake, which was a real treat. We were really impressed by the forests and mountains around the city. We made good use of the swimming pool, though we were too lazy to go to the famous markets. We didn't take advantage of all the shows either. Lots of people told us how good they were, so that was a pity. And the theatres themselves were supposed to be impressive. Speaker 3.
One of my main ambitions was to see inside the big concert hall. And in fact, we managed to get into a concert there, which was pretty special. The acoustics were amazing. The city was divided by a river, and getting round had its problems, especially as we didn't really understand the city plan. The best way was the ferries. I was really impressed that they were always on time and provided good views in the city. The trams were good too, and the local commuters seemed happy to chat to us and give us ideas for the best things to do and see. We didn't have time to do everything, though.
Speaker 4.
Before we went, we couldn't decide where to stay. So many people recommended different places, and there seemed to be loads of different and unusual possibilities, like old traditional farms converted into guest houses. So we decided to move around and try something different every couple of nights. That worked out really well, and they were all excellent. Although we'd been told that getting round on the buses was easy and cheap in the city, we decided to rent a car so that we could get out into the countryside. We didn't want to miss out on the views driving along by the ocean.
Speaker 5.
Even though we had a city plan, we got lost several times, especially in the old town where the buildings were quite similar. Though I know some people say getting lost is the best way to get to know a city. We were never short of help, though. Some people were even prepared to walk with us to show us the way, and that was something I'll always remember. Our hotel was all right without being spectacular, and it was a long walk into the evening shows. We took a taxi most times. There was loads to do every day, though, and we certainly weren't bored.
Now you will hear part 3 again. Speaker 1.
We spent a day exploring the shops and markets in the city and bought some souvenirs. Then we wanted to see some of the area outside the city and discovered it was easy to get to loads of places by train, including the mountains, where we were told there were great hostels. You can do bushwalks out there, and apparently the scenery is stunning. But it can be dangerous. We were warned to have the right gear and tell other people where we were going, so we decided to give it a miss. Anyway, we weren't short of things to do in the city. We were spoilt for choice.
Speaker 2. We were pretty tired when we first arrived, so we were glad just to relax. We'd booked late, and I have to say that the room wasn't the best I've stayed in, but we had a view of the lake, which was a real treat. We were really impressed by the forests and mountains around the city. We made good use of the swimming pool, though we were too lazy to go to the famous markets. We didn't take advantage of all the shows either. Lots of people told us how good they were, so that was a pity. And the theatres themselves were supposed to be impressive.
Speaker 3. One of my main ambitions was to see inside the big concert hall, and in fact we managed to get into a concert there, which was pretty special. The acoustics were amazing. The city was divided by a river, and getting round had its problems, especially as we didn't really understand the city plan. The best way was the ferries. I was really impressed that they were always on time and provided good views in the city. The trams were good too, and the local commuters seemed happy to chat to us and give us ideas for the best things to do and see. We didn't have time to do everything, though.
Speaker 4.
Before we went, we couldn't decide where to stay. So many people recommended different places, and there seemed to be loads of different and unusual possibilities, like old traditional farms converted into guest houses. So we decided to move around and try something different every couple of nights. That worked out really well, and they were all excellent. Although we'd been told that getting round on the buses was easy and cheap in the city, we decided to rent a car so that we could get out into the countryside. We didn't want to miss out on the views driving along by the ocean.
Speaker 5.
Even though we had a city plan, we got lost several times, especially in the old town where the buildings were quite similar. Though I know some people say getting lost is the best way to get to know a city. We were never short of help, though. Some people were even prepared to walk with us to show us the way, and that was something I'll always remember. Our hotel was all right without being spectacular, and it was a long walk into the evening shows. We took a taxi most times. There was loads to do every day, though, and we certainly weren't bored.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You will hear part of a radio interview with a woman called Rachel Reed, who works in a commercial art gallery, a shop which sells works of art. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B, or C. You now have 1 minute to look at part 4.
This evening, in our series Careers with a Difference, our guest is Rachel Reed, who works for a small commercial art gallery. Rachel, welcome.
Hello.
Rachel, what exactly do you do?
Well, there's two great things about working for a really small company. Firstly, you get to do a bit of everything. The other is that you can practically invent your job title. Mine is marketing manager, although I do a lot of other things too. It does describe the majority of what I do.
So, tell us about your day.
Well, it all starts with the huge pile of post we get. We often get artists sending in photographs of their work to see if we'd be interested in exhibiting it. I learned very early on how to differentiate between the possibles and those which are unsuitable.
But how do you tell?
It might be the style, or sometimes the subject matter is just not going to look right in our gallery. But more often than not, it's just that they're not of the required standard. The possibles I pass on to the gallery manager, who makes the final decision.
So you have quite a lot of contact with artists?
Yes. Sometimes I spend nearly all day on the phone, and about 50% of the time it's artists. I send letters explaining why we can't show their work. Some of them phone up to argue about it. I find those calls very hard to deal with. Artists we do exhibit also phone to find out if we've managed to sell anything and, if we have, when the money will be coming through. I don't mind those so much. Most other calls are from clients. We have a new artist exhibiting here every 2 to 4 weeks, and before the show takes place, we send out a catalogue to the clients on our database.
obviously the catalogue's illustrated.
Oh, yes. And as soon as the catalogue goes out, we start getting phone calls because people see something they like and want to reserve it. Sometimes they even buy things over the phone. The catalogue also contains a commentary about the artist, which I have to write and research. I try to find out what has influenced them, where they learned to paint, what the subject matter represents, that sort of thing. But I try to avoid quoting from positive reviews of their work. It's not meant to be advertising as such.
So your job is not all administrative?
Compared to a typical office, that side of it's quite minimal. That's why I can cope without an assistant. There are systems in place to deal with routine jobs. For instance, I don't have to send out the catalogues. The company which prints them also prints the envelopes and posts them. Another company takes care of the food and drinks when we have the opening of a new exhibition.
And are you involved in other aspects of the business?
Yes. We also offer a consultancy service for large companies that want to display works of art in their offices. I phone round companies, explain what we do, and if they're interested, make an appointment for the gallery manager to go and see them. It's interesting. The companies tend to go much more for modern or abstract art than people coming to the gallery.
And the best part of the job for you?
The really rewarding thing for me is that you never know how a day is going to go. Some days it'll be really quiet, other days it's really busy and you don't know what you're going to have to cope with. And there's the added bonus of working with really nice people. And, of course, I have the pleasure of spending my days surrounded by beautiful works of art. So I can't complain.
Thank you, Rachel. And now we'll move on to something.
Now you will hear part four again.
This evening, in our series Careers with a Difference, our guest is Rachel Reed, who works for a small commercial art gallery. Rachel, welcome.
Hello.
Rachel, what exactly do you do?
Well, there's two great things about working for a really small company. Firstly, you get to do a bit of everything. The other is that you can practically invent your job title. Mine is marketing manager, although I do a lot of other things too. It does describe the majority of what I do.
So, tell us about your day.
Well, it all starts with the huge pile of post we get. We often get artists sending in photographs of their work to see if we'd be interested in exhibiting it. I learned very early on how to differentiate between the possibles and those which are unsuitable.
But how do you tell?
It might be the style, or sometimes the subject matter is just not going to look right in our gallery. But more often than not, it's just that they're not of the required standard. The possibles I pass on to the gallery manager, who makes the final decision.
So you have quite a lot of contact with artists?
Yes. Sometimes I spend nearly all day on the phone, and about 50% of the time it's artists. I send letters explaining why we can't show their work. Some of them phone up to argue about it. I find those calls very hard to deal with. Artists we do exhibit also phone to find out if we've managed to sell anything and, if we have, when the money will be coming through. I don't mind those so much. Most other calls are from clients. We have a new artist exhibiting here every 2 to 4 weeks, and before the show takes place, we send out a catalogue to the clients on our database.
Obviously, the catalogue's illustrated.
Oh, yes. And as soon as the catalogue goes out, we start getting phone calls because people see something they like and want to reserve it. Sometimes they even buy things over the phone. The catalogue also contains a commentary about the artist, which I have to write and research. I try to find out what has influenced them, where they learned to paint, what the subject matter represents, that sort of thing. But I try to avoid quoting from positive reviews of their work. It's not meant to be advertising as such.
So your job is not all administrative?
Compared to a typical office, that side of it's quite minimal. That's why I can cope without an assistant. There are systems in place to deal with routine jobs. For instance, I don't have to send out the catalogues. The company which prints them also prints the envelopes and posts them. Another company takes care of the food and drinks when we have the opening of a new exhibition.
And are you involved in other aspects of the business?
Yes. We also offer a consultancy service for large companies that want to display works of art in their offices. I phone round companies, explain what we do, and if they're interested, make an appointment for the gallery manager to go and see them. It's interesting. The companies tend to go much more for modern or abstract art than people coming to the gallery.
And the best part of the job for you?
The really rewarding thing for me is that you never know how a day is going to go. Some days it'll be really quiet. Other days it's really busy and you don't know what you're going to have to cope with. And there's the added bonus of working with really nice people. And, of course, I have the pleasure of spending my days surrounded by beautiful works of art. So I can't complain.
Thank you, Rachel. And now we'll move on to something.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left, so that you are sure to finish in time. You have one more minute left. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.